This is DGMT's Learning Lunch, and I'm your host, Rahima Aesop. Today's Nourish and Flourish conversation is about social employment. You will be forgiven if this term seems foreign to you, or if you are hearing it for the first time. The term is gaining currency thanks to the initiation of the Social Employment Fund, also known as the SEF, a publicly funded job-creating mechanism that forms part of efforts to stimulate the South African economy. But for those in the know, social employment has the potential to tackle some of our biggest challenges because it involves channeling public funds into sectors that are already promoting work for the common good. The pilot round of the Social Employment Fund has been a steep learning curve for the organizations participating in the program. They've hit the ground running from day one while navigating the inevitable teething problems of a new fund with its unique host of administrative challenges. To talk about social employment, what civil society has learned from implementing this initiative, as well as what it will take for greater public investment in this idea, I'm joined by my guest Katie Houston, Head of Research, Innovation and Impact at Nalibali, Sibongile Kumalo, Executive Director of the Learning Trust, and Andrew Borain, the CEO of the Western Cape Economic Development Partnership, also known as EDP. Welcome, everyone. I'll start with you, Andrew. Let's start by breaking down this concept of social employment. What is it and why does it matter in the South African context?
Rimi, obviously we have a massive general unemployment crisis, particularly amongst our young people and particularly for people in poor and vulnerable communities. And so there's a whole bunch of things that government and private sector and communities are trying to do about that. It's our biggest crisis, and it contributes hugely to both poverty and inequality in our society. Social employment focuses on employment that creates what we can call social value. Or another way to look at it is to talk about employment schemes that create community benefit or public benefit. So, for example, someone running a community kitchen, feeding people, that's adding community benefit. Someone planting a community garden or a school garden or a garden in partnership with an early childhood development center, that's adding community benefit. So any jobs or employment opportunities in that field, we regard as adding social value at a community level.
So how did this initiative come about? Because it is part of the government stimulus package in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic.
This is a public employment program with a twist. So it generates incomes for the participants, which is the normal aim of public employment, to directly address poverty on the ground and improve household incomes in poor areas. It also adds to the experience and the possibilities of further employment for the participants, which is what a normal public employment program does. But this one particularly supports work for the common good. It supports work for public benefit. And in that way, it's slightly different.
So social employment is a fairly new concept. Is there appetite within government to continue with this initiative beyond the pilot phase?
The pilot phase has to prove itself. It's early days, but I think that there is value being shown, and I think we have to communicate that value to government, to the decision makers in government, to the people who plan the budgets for the next couple of years, but also to the public at large and to grassroots communities and to NGOs and civil society organizations and local government. That's exactly one of the reasons why we put together the Social Employment Network, which is sitting behind the Social Employment Fund. I think we are assembling good evidence, both quantitative impact and qualitative impact. But now we have to communicate that so that this program is supported in the long term.
Let's actually talk about that. Tell me about the evidence that is emerging, both quantitative and qualitative.
Well, on the quantitative side, you see the amounts of funding transferred from the national fiscus every month to the participants. So obviously they have more money. And if you talk to any of the participants on the ground, particularly those that have never worked formally in their lives before, this is having a profound impact. Not only having a bit of extra disposable income, but also the psychological impact of being able to feel valued by doing a job for the community and by being involved in a formal program of work. And there are scores, countless stories coming back from the ground, from all the civil society organizations involved in this program, documenting the impact on people's dignity. Dignity that has been stripped away by poverty, by unemployment, by the inequalities in our society. And people are communicating very strongly that this makes them feel part of something and has helped to restore their dignity.
And what has the Social Employment Network, this is a community of practice for NGOs that are part of the pilot phase, what has this network learned about implementation thus far? I'm sure there have been a few teething problems in the beginning, but what are the main lessons that are emerging?
As a pilot project, of course, there have been teething problems on the technical side, on the communication side, on the financial payment side, on the design side, and that's normal. What the Social Employment Network has brought in is an adaptive programming and delivery aspect. In other words, instead of waiting to the end of the program to find out what went wrong at the beginning, we are able to build in feedback loops to immediately take the experience on the ground and some of the difficulties encountered and flip that back in a formal channel to government, so that government can then be more responsive by rapidly responding and adapting and adjusting and changing the program in midstream to have more impact. And I think that's been the power of the Social Employment Network. And by learning by doing, what we mean is in the middle of implementing, you take a step back, you pause even for 1 hour or 2 hours or half a day, and you reflect on what's happening, what's working, what's not working. You learn from that, and through that learning and sharing that learning with your peers, so it's not just what you are experiencing, it's listening to what other people are experiencing, good and bad, you can then adapt and adjust what you are doing in terms of your practice. You can help other people to learn and adapt and adjust, and obviously feed that back to government and help government learn and adapt and adjust.
Is that the primary role of the EDP in this initiative, to ensure that that learning is surfaced, to convene the strategic implementing partners? Would you say that is the primary role?
Well, the EDP is what we call a collaborative intermediary organization. And in this particular project, supported by the DG Murray Trust, we are offering an independent or neutral platform so that the participants in this program can come together in a safe space and they can actually talk about what's not going right. And not everyone wants to do that. You always want to promote what you're doing and you're doing it well, and you want to report to your funders and your board that everything's going fine. And what we've done through this network is create a space where people can actually look self-critically and say, this is not working. We need to adapt or adjust or change. And I think that's the value of the platform that we've been able to connect, because in a sense, as a neutral party, we are not competing for the funds. We are not implementing the programs. So our role is to listen deeply and hear what people are saying, what participants are saying, what the more grassroots informal structures and partners and networks that the civil society organizations are working with, what the civil society organizations themselves are saying, and also what government is saying. And our job is to assemble that in a way that everyone can hear each other. Because often we find in development circles, people talk foreign languages to each other. There's government speak, there's political speak, technocratic speak, community speak, academic and research speak. And our job is to bring those different voices together in a way that makes sense.
I'd like to bring Katie and Sibongile into the conversation now so that we can talk about some of those teething problems. Katie, let's turn to you. How has your involvement in the SCF helped Nalibali to achieve its own strategic objectives?
Thanks. So, I mean, in so many ways, it's been really, really exciting to be part of this program. As Nalibali, we're an organization that, if we want to put it in a nutshell, we want all children to fall in love with reading, to have plentiful opportunities to enjoy books and stories, and for that to start at a really young age, even before they get to school. Prior to joining this fund, we had a field team of about 40 people. Now we have a field team of 1,040 people. So I really think just at a very basic level, it's helped us to increase our reach and then obviously then increase our impact in so many ways. And I think in particular to increase our work with families. So about a year ago, we did a strategy review. We realized we really need to do more and more work in the homes and with parents and caregivers, because that's really a missed opportunity for so many children whose parents are not always aware of how capable young children are and not always aware of the ways that you can use storytelling and singing and even wordless picture books that don't have any words in them to stimulate the imagination. So this project has allowed us to run a massive home visiting campaign, which is something that we had tried in little bits and pieces in a few of our projects, but this is the first time we've been able to try it at scale. So it scales up the impact. It also scales up the learning. So we're able to see much more quickly what's working, what isn't working, what do we need to change. So that's been incredibly exciting. And the kind of stories coming back around, you know, gosh, we thought reading was something for rich people, is something we're hearing coming back from the communities saying, actually, now we see it's for everyone. I've seen so many pictures of grandfathers who maybe have never sat with their children or grandchildren, you know, and they're sitting with a two-year-old. And often there's this mindset that you don't read to a kid that can't talk or can't read themselves. So we're starting to see that mindset shifting in communities about what children are capable of and about what the adults in their lives are capable of, the power that you have, even if you can't read yourself, to help a child sort of get on that positive developmental trajectory and really reach their potential. So there's the impact piece, but I think what's also been exciting is that the young people we are working with, so these 1,000 young people, are themselves developing the mindsets and skills which will infuse in the community in all these different ways even after the project is over. So this idea that reading is for everyone, that reading starts when you're small, that I have the power to change this. There's new social norms that are being created in these communities because we are working at scale with 10 facilitators in each team. And then I think another thing that's been really positive, the last one, is we're positioning working with children as this really exciting, attractive job opportunity. And we've had people participating say, you know, I'd never thought I could work with children. I thought it would be impossible, or I didn't know I loved this. And I think that's really exciting when we think about the need to grow the early learning workforce and to grow the teacher workforce. There are so many people out there who are well suited to this work and haven't had the chance to find out. And we've been able to give people that chance.
Thanks, Katie. I want to touch on this notion of scale. How was Nalibali able to scale its reach to 1,000 additional participants without necessarily scaling its operational capacity in a very short space of time?
Great question. Through a lot of hard work. We had to be really innovative. I think the most people we had ever onboarded in one go before was about 80. So jumping to 1,000 was a really big leap, and we just had to think about doing things differently. What does a standardized recruitment process look like for 1,000 people? What does a training process look like for 1,000 people that all need to be trained in the space of a month? I think what was really amazing about all of this work was that everyone on our team was so excited about this opportunity. Because for the first time, we have all these volunteers we've trained over the years, and we were never able to give them paid work. So for the first time, we can go to these grandmothers who have been doing storytelling, people who have been running reading clubs out of their own homes, and say, we've actually got a job for you. So the innovation that was coming up from our colleagues in all the different provinces, leading the work on the ground, working with partner nonprofits all around the country who are the ones who really enable everything to happen at a local level, I've just been astounded by the way we've managed to problem solve and come up with new solutions.
Thanks, Katie. Sibongile, to you now. Perhaps give us a sense of how the Learning Trust has been able to leverage the Social Employment Fund for its own strategic objectives.
Thanks, Rahima. So the Learning Trust, let me say, is an intermediary grant maker. So we work through implementing partners who are after-school programs. We essentially package grants to after-school programs and we support them with organizational development. And so for us, it's been beyond about the Learning Trust and more about our implementing partners and how we enable them to hire people, how we enable them to grow their capacity as organizations and take up public funding. And so we are acting as an intermediary and a secretariat in what we call the Catch-Up Coalition. And essentially the mission is to have organizations acting collectively around COVID recovery from the learning backlogs that we've seen and supporting organizations to get more people on board in delivering learning services to children. And so we've been able to employ over 3,300 people across 38 different organizations. And these are organizations across the country in all 9 provinces, in some remote areas, in a lot of townships, rural areas, and that sort of thing. And we've employed young people mostly as after-school assistants. So they are attached to an after-school program that very often is attached to a local school or multiple local schools. And the Social Employment Fund has enabled us basically to sustain the work of after-school programs and to sustain our own organization.
We've heard Andrew talk about the value of social employment. And I want to put this question to the two of you, starting with you, Sibongile. The intention of the Social Employment Fund is to stimulate an economic workforce whose activities contribute to the common good. Are we seeing the ripple effects of this investment in the communities that have been traditionally and historically undervalued and under-resourced?
And the short answer to that is absolutely. We've got a ton of young people who have just never had jobs before. A lot of young people who exited school and never went into tertiary education, and very many that actually are graduates and are struggling to find jobs. And so the value of money in their pocket at the end of each month where they're able to support their families is just something they've never had before. And then secondly, I think what's been really valuable is the training aspect of it. So we've been able to support young people with personal development, job readiness kind of training. There's some challenges obviously associated with that. A lot of it is available on an app and there's obviously limitations to data and that sort of thing. But I think this is learning and education, extended education that young people who are doing these jobs just wouldn't have access to. And I also just think generally communities have been doing the work. There's no shortage of work in South Africa, and communities and community organizations have been doing it. It's just been under-resourced and undervalued. And now we're sending the message that the work that they're doing is valuable and is valued.
Mm. Katie, same question to you. What is the ripple effect that you are seeing in these communities where participants are operating and are spreading the Nalibali message?
I would echo everything Sibongile said. I love the last point you've made about sending the message that this work is valuable. A lot of it was already happening, but in more informal ways. I love seeing payroll of 1.7, 1.8 million going off every month. It is a wonderful feeling to know we are able to put that much money into people's pockets and into people's homes through the work that we're doing. I think just maybe to add to the points you've made, another one is we've seen this opportunity catalyze a lot of additional volunteering for people. So I've been hearing stories about, oh, well, we're also running a reading club on a Saturday because not all the kids can come in the week. People aren't being paid for that extra time, but they now have the skills, the venue, there's demand from the children, so they're doing it. Someone else who reported, well, I see that the kids are really struggling with reading, so I'm also tutoring them in my days off. And that's not something we asked anyone to do, but someone, I think, and I mean, we would love to see this work full time. We would love to see it paid even more because we think it's so valuable. But I think even when someone has part-time work at minimum wage, we have seen that creating more opportunity for people, more stability. And I think it's wonderful. People saying, we noticed the kids in our reading clubs weren't well dressed. So as a team, we gathered donations and we gave it to those children because we didn't want them to be wearing tattered clothes and to be without shoes. I mean, for me, these are all these kind of little stories about people seeing, I'm doing this work already and I'm excited about this. And with the skills and new connections, I can actually even take this further. I think that's quite an amazing spillover effect of the project in communities.
Katie, I want to touch on that. The Social Employment Fund is a limited funding period. It does create work opportunities. And as both of you have described, that has resulted in positive ripple effects for the communities. But talk me through the learning journey of the participant. How are they supported and enabled to continue on their sort of employment journeys going forward beyond the Social Employment Fund?
It's a great question. And I think we won't be able to offer everyone a job when they're done. But what we want to do is with the time that we have to give them as many skills as possible and experience as possible. And just to have that line on their CV that says, I worked for Nali Bali for almost a year. Those things will hopefully open up a lot more doors and also just develop the sort of self-belief and the self-confidence that I'm valuable. I have a lot to contribute. And I think just the way the program's designed, people are developing so many skills and we just have to make sure we articulate that. You are developing planning skills if you are in this program. You are learning to think on your feet when the plan changes, the ECD is closed, there's a funeral, it's raining. How are you going to problem solve? You're learning to facilitate and to work with groups of children, which is an incredible skill we need so much more of in this country with the huge shortage that we have of early learning practitioners and coming up a huge shortage of teachers as well. So I think, it's quite an important opportunity to develop those skills that we need.
Sibongile, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to add to that the huge shortage of teachers coming. I mean, Harambee's research and the Year Beyond, the Western Cape Youth and After School Program Office, have done research and found that more than 65% of the young people that have been working on their programs actually get retained in the sector. So these are young people that go on to study education, become teachers, and get absorbed into those NGOs over time.
And I think something we're seeing, and this is one of those mixed blessings sort of things, you do see a lot of turnover when you have 1,000 people. Every month we see people leaving. But if those people are leaving for a new job opportunity or they're leaving to study, they're leaving because they've got a stepping stone into something else, as much as we might be saying, oh dear, we've got to train someone new and we've got to onboard someone new, it's actually a huge success. And every person that leaves our project because they've had a better opportunity, we need to be celebrating and shouting from the rooftops that this is a wonderful thing that's happening.
Sibongile, what advice can you give other NGOs who may want to apply for the SEF in the next funding round?
I think what was really important for the after-school sector was the coordination piece. So it was quite timely that we convened the Catch-Up Coalition and were able to create a collective space for organizations to act together and to be able to respond to this opportunity. And so it's an organic group. People come and go. The Catch-Up Coalition is also kind of project-driven. So over and above the Social Employment Fund, we're creating other projects for organizations to do because there's really a huge gap in terms of learning that needs to be filled. And so I think the one piece of advice I'd give to organizations is collaboration.
Andrew, a last question to end off with. What will it take for the SEF to become a permanent feature of our public funding landscape?
So my experience with public policy is that they are often competing imperatives at national level in the public policy realm. And there's only so much money to go around. And that's often a difficulty in a budgeting process, to get clarity on what the priorities are and to get agreement and to go beyond institutional self-interest. So, for example, right now, national government is faced with competing challenges to be funded. There's a whole group saying, put money into small business development. That's where the sustainable jobs are. And that's not wrong. There's equally a strong lobby saying the best way to help poor people is to increase the social grants or get more people into the social welfare system, social support system, give the money to us. And in parallel to that, there's a whole bunch of people working on the just transition, decarbonization, and social justice, and they need money for that. And equally, there's another bunch of people working on a possibility of a new public health scheme. And so these are all competing requirements. And I think if we approach these things from an either-or point of view, it's either small business development or social employment, we're getting ourselves into a tangle. I think that investing in social employment, which is both delivering much-needed community services and preparing people for participation in the more formal workforce when formal job opportunities arrive or where they can start their own business, it's not an either-or situation. It's got to be a both-and. And somehow, public policy has got to encompass the both-and rather than the either-or.
Yeah, and on that point, I think there's two other things that I can offer. One is a lot of the money from the IDC, from Treasury, is reserved for wage payments. So 80% of the budget is ring-fenced for wages. And so I think that creates an opportunity for business and philanthropy to come on board, particularly giving unrestricted funding that supports organizations and that supports specifically the operations of it all. So I think it's an opportunity for building an ecosystem of support, really an investment around employment in the country so that it's not only government's responsibility. And then secondly, I also think it probably needs to move out of the presidency's project management office and really be embedded and absorbed into departments and the administration of it into local and provincial offices as well. And maybe that's when we will see maybe a long-term view with the social employment funding.
Andrew, you want to add something?
Well, I think it's in addition to the potential of blended finance to create collective impact, we also see that this program is strengthening the partnering capabilities of all the participants. And my advice to NGOs that want to participate in the next round, sharpen up on your partnering capabilities, because this is a sort of program that has been designed to operate at scale. And many smaller NGOs don't operate at scale. Or they don't operate in partnership with other sectors. They stick in their lane, or they just operate in one local area. And this program is designed deliberately to encourage partnering across sectors. So do the health people talk to the food people, talk to the education people, or do we stick in separate sectors? It's encouraging NGOs from one local community to team up with NGOs in other areas, in other regions, in fact. And I think by participating in this program and joining forces through the social employment network and doing peer-to-peer learning and joint problem solving, it has strengthened the impetus towards collaboration and partnering more generally, not just for this program, but for the way in which people will work in the future. As the EDB, we stand ready to support NGOs that want to learn about tips and tricks of partnering, how to work with difference, how to work with other sectors, how to work with other NGOs that perhaps they are not familiar with. And we can certainly support them. We can put them in touch with the larger civil society organizations that have the experience of contracting with government on putting together big applications like this, on dealing with large amounts of financing that have the management structures. And that is why this whole program is based on a partnership between larger NGOs with the capacity to engage and transact with government, which can be very frustrating and quite bureaucratic, and at the same time also work with the more informal grassroots networks on the ground that connect both government and the NGOs acting as intermediaries with the people who most need the resources that this program offers.
To summarize, social employment is not only creating work opportunities, but also social value in communities. The implementation of the SEF has been a sharp learning curve for NGOs that are rapidly growing their reach, embracing newer ways of monitoring and evaluating their programs, and learning to lean on their existing networks during implementation of their own programs. This initiative truly has the potential to take South Africa forward. And now over to you, those listening to this podcast. Using what you have heard today, you can try this reflective exercise at home or with your colleagues. You'll need a pen and paper to write down these steps or download the takeaway sheet from our website, learninglunch.dgmt.co.za. Write down the following questions and spend some time reflecting on them by yourself, and then share your reflections with your colleagues. Question number one. How will social employment bring value to my community? What is my role in promoting social value in my community? How can my organization leverage its social networks to scale its reach? And is my organization able to scale up without scaling organizational capacity? This has been DGMT's Learning Lunch. Until next time.